I'm going to call the Public Safety Finance Division Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Members, if you would look at the minutes for Thursday, January 29th. Are there any questions or additions to the minutes? Seeing none, we will vote. All those in favor of the minutes, of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. I'd like to first thank Representative Olin for taking over for me while I was gone part of the week last week. Thank you, Representative Olin. Today we are going to review three agencies that are under our division: the Uniform Laws Commission, the Private Detective Board, and the Board of Peace Officers Standards and Trainings. And first on the agenda is the Uniform Laws Commission, and Judge Jack Davies, who's the commissioner, one of the commissioners of the commission, will, Judge, if you could give us maybe just a brief overview. There's new members on this committee of what exactly the Uniform Law Commissioners do, and then we'll go over your very small budget.
Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, the Uniform Laws Commission is a group of volunteers from every state in the Union and the District of Columbia, in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, but Puerto Rico doesn't show up, but the Virgin Islands are very peaceful. This group are all lawyers, supported only by state appropriations and an occasional grant from some groups if it's interested in one of our projects. Drafts uniform legislation. The constituency of the organization is entirely state legislature. We draft legislation, and then on a volunteer basis, we bring it to each of our respective legislatures and attempt to get it passed. The Minnesota commissioners are myself, Bob Tennyson, who is very familiar to you all, Harry Hainsworth, Judge Harriet Lansing. Harry Hainsworth is the retired dean of the William Mitchell College of Law, the revisor of statutes. Bob Stein, the retired dean, now teaching at the University of Minnesota, and Mike Sullivan, who's retired president of Dairy Queen. Now, I said retired a lot of times. We all started way back before we were retired, and we've loved this organization and have hung in there over the years. And all of the Minnesota commissioners are very active. In fact, we have four members of the executive committee of the organization are from Minnesota right at the moment. We try to keep that secret at the conference, but we're well recognized. We've brought to the state of Minnesota legislature a great many bills over the years. They have been enacted to a very large extent, and I think we have between 50 and 60 uniform acts on the book currently. We'd like you to increase that number very substantially this year. So, are you up to questions at this point?
Judge, when you say uniform acts, so there's a list of them, members. You have a packet in your small town.
You all have your annual report together.
Yeah. So starting on page 5, you get in 6, 7, you get an idea of some of the acts. So when you say uniform, is the language in these identical from state to state, or is it... Tell me more about it.
Mr. Chairman, we always start off hoping it will be uniform. We have a little trouble with the Minnesota Bar Association. It's an aggressive group that always finds little nitpicks that they like to put into the act. But the basic idea is to try to avoid conflict between the states in areas particularly where that's a real problem. The big product of the conference over the last half century is the Uniform Commercial Code. Now, with the Commercial Code, uniformity is very important because commercial transactions cross state lines, and you have to have a uniform law regulating those transactions. In other areas where the conference works, uniformity is not quite so important, but what the conference tries to do is tackle subject matters which are particularly complex and difficult, and we work over a 2 or 3 year period of polishing the act and trying to accommodate various interests so there's no conflict. We try to bring the acts to the legislatures with the fight taken out of us, is what we hope to do, which is of great, great benefit to the legislature.
So, Judge, if I'm getting this correctly, this, your activities mostly deal with commercial transactions, commercial laws in obtaining uniformity.
That's the biggest thing the conference has done. But the Minnesota Probate Law, for example, is a uniform act in large part. We have this year a 3/8 of an inch thick act which we have introduced, which has 5 uniform acts in it, which we'd like to have enacted. We have the Bar Association studying that at the moment, and when we get the go-ahead from the Bar Association, we'll tell the legislature, and we hope to pass those parts of the of that act which the Bar Association approves. And that they don't approve, we'll take crack at next year.
The commission doesn't explore criminal acts then?
But we have had, we've dealt with sentencing a little bit way back in one little period. But by and large, it's not criminal.
Any members of the committee have any questions? Mr. Davies. Mr. Cole.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Judge Davies, do you know how other states fund their commissioners? Is it full funding through legislative appropriation like we've done historically here in Minnesota, or are there other models that other states use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, all the states depend on legislative appropriation, but what? Oregon, the state legislature appropriates the dues, but the travel expenses of the commissioners from Oregon are paid by a trust that was established by one of the Oregon commissioners years and years ago, one of the deceased, the late Jim Dessendorf. He loved the commission so much that he wanted to make sure that the Oregon commission always went, so he financed it. But that's the only thing. Aside from that, they're all financed. The dues and the travel expenses approved by legislative appropriation. If that's all, I want you all to understand, that's the only thing that's in our appropriation, are the dues to the conference, which pays for our committee meetings where we work. The normal committee meeting is a Friday, Saturday, and a Sunday morning. And the travel expenses for those are paid by the conference with the state dues. And the other expenses, the commissioners of Minnesota's expenses for attendance at a week-long annual meeting. And that's the only thing that's in the appropriation system. We don't have quite enough in the governor's budget that we can live with.
Representative Cole. Oh, no. Mr. Davis, thank you very much for your testimony.
Well, thank you for your attention and your past affection.
Okay, next we'll be hearing from the Private Detective Board, Marie Ullman. Ms. Ullman, if you want to, again, we have some new members on the committee, so maybe give us a little history of the board and what your mission is, and then take us through your budget.
Absolutely. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As you suggest, it's perhaps always helpful every couple of years to have a refresher or an introduction to what the Private Detective and Protective Agent Services Board does. We are a fee-driven board, and those fees are deposited into the general fund from which we receive an appropriation from the legislature. We have a five-member board, which represents law enforcement, the public, as well as the industries that we regulate. The board meets on a monthly basis to conduct their primary business, which is to review license applicants and license reissuance applicants and approve training providers. The board judiciously reviews candidates for licensing to ensure that there is compliance with statutory requirements, and they review license reissuances, which is an auditing process, which also seeks to ensure that those requirements are being maintained, including the mandated training and the response to any violations that are found in that process. The board manages over 300 license holders in the private detective and private security service provider area. The board also manages more than 80 training providers that are representative of more than 700 approved training courses. The board has also engaged the license holder community in the training approval process, allowing the license holders to contribute their expertise and to share its commitment to sound practices in these industries. Some of the service areas that are represented by these license holders are uniform guard and patrol services, armored car services, event security, executive protection, investigations that are conducted for corporations, pre-employment and employment investigations, insurance fraud investigations. They're becoming increasingly visible in public areas such as shopping malls and business complexes, government buildings, airports, and nuclear power plants. Several thousand people are employees of these licensed services in Minnesota, for which we monitor the completion of criminal history record checks, issuance of identification, and compliance with training. These services provide a key support to government public safety efforts. The ratio of a private security community to public law enforcement is roughly 3 private security officers to 1 public law enforcement officer. The sustained growth of these services has brought about a reliance on the availability and visibility of these services in our communities. It brings about an assumed authority, potential for abuse of that authority, that can bring with it concerns on use of force and protection of people's personal information, for example, in these service areas. These concerns are shared by the industry as they seek to have a more positive relationship with the public and law enforcement. In response to a strained budget outlook, the board is examining a number of different areas, including looking at our legislation, both the enabling legislation as well as our administrative rules, to look at ways that we can streamline our process without compromising the regulatory program. We're exploring the possible use of online capabilities that may be available to expedite processes for us that will help our licensees as well as reduce staff time for us. In regards to an outlook of what a 5% reduction would impact, or how that would impact us rather, that was roughly $14,000 for the full biennium, and that will directly impact in our personnel cost area, reducing our support staff time. And if that were to be a 10% reduction, that would be $26,000 for the biennium, and that would directly also impact our budget support staff area, reducing that position a bit further. That's generally an overall look at what we do and who we service, and a little bit about what a reduction would impact, how it would impact us. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions that the committee may have.
Ms. Ullman, do other states have comparable boards that regulate private detectives?
Mr. Chairman, across the country it can vary. Some states have boards such as we do. Other agencies also are responsible for the steering of that legislative activity. It's done through Department of Public Safety's, Attorney General's offices, through regulatory agencies that have been created that handle just regulatory activity. So there's a real variety out there.
And was there a reason that this board was set up with this relative economy to provide this regulation?
Mr. Chairman, if I understand your question, the board itself was created back in the early 70s. Prior to that time, regulatory activity for these services occurred in a couple of different areas of state government, both directly out of the governor's office and then also through the Secretary of State's office, just to name a couple. I think that the board activity is one way in which the industry and the public have the opportunity to participate in the regulatory process for a professional license. And I believe that was the attractive aspect in adopting a board approach to the regulation of these services.
Representative Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want this to seem as if I'm picking on you because you're a small budget. Board knows that if I know how it feels to get picked on for being small. But I think that I read what... thank you, Representative Cole. I read what your core functions are, and then I flip back in this book and I read what the post board functions are. I'm wondering if you have an opinion about a merge of those to put your functions into the post board, whether you feel that look at the post board up there getting a little nervous with some money obviously to do this, but do you feel it would jeopardize the integrity of what you have to do? I mean, I'm just wondering your opinion on that being merged into the post board.
Ms. Ullman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, all due respect to Mr. Melton, who I've counted a longtime friend, there are two separate sorts of regulatory functions, although I believe there's a supportive aspect in terms of the our communities as a whole, certainly, but there are certainly different charges. There has not been previous discussion about that potential. However, we are also a fee-driven agency, and merged activity, as I understand it, would bring those activities with it. So certainly a more particular discussion certainly could be had to talk about what benefits could arise from such a circumstance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, and I get that. I know they're not identical, but I look at the fact that, you know, you're issuing and reviewing licenses, you're evaluating criteria, and I know the post board does that in a broader, you know, broader sense, and they also have the training and stuff like that. But I guess in these times, and again, I know that in the grand scheme of our budget, you know, you are a very tiny sliver of that, but do you think that it would, I guess, jeopardize the safety or the integrity of private detectives to have to go to a different building, if you would, and have and get reviewed and kind of go through that? I mean, I guess that's my concern. I am, you know, what I consider a fiscal conservative, in my opinion, Representative Cole. And I think that I don't want to jeopardize public safety for this, you know, dealing with the budget. But I think in the end, when we're looking at efficiency in government and what you do and what the Post Board does, they are extremely similar. With I would say the Post Board has a greater scheme of things. But I guess I'm asking is, do you think if we would do that, would it jeopardize the safety or the integrity of the people you are issuing license to?
Ms. Ullman, do you want to try that again?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the activities in terms of how they're approached are very different in terms of who is licensed, for example. With our agency, we license the entity that provides the service as opposed to individual people. In response to your question, I think it's more of a practical sort of approach. I'm not sure what would be accomplished in terms of bringing us under the Post Board. That's not to say that a more extensive and detailed conversation certainly can't be had. And I apologize if I'm not hitting the mark.
Representative Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Ullman, I've got a couple of questions. First, the handout that we've got says under the administered 36 military arrest property examinations. Could you elaborate on the professions that were addressed in that reciprocity examination? Was that for commercial carriers, or was that do you have any information on that?
You might be referring to
the Post Board.
They're coming up next.
No problem.
Okay, save your question.
Well,
one follow-up question here. During this last biennium, I was contacted by a constituency that dealt with the escort services for vehicles, and just to kind of give the committee a little background, escort services are those vehicles that go ahead and behind extended loads, have the flashing lights, and some of the security requirements that are entailed in that, and some of the it's not the normal escort service in the terms of that you would think the escort services, we aren't thinking membership here. The kind of the crux of the thing was that there was some increased requirements that had been laid on that particular service, such that it caused me some concern, some questions as to where it originated from, and some of those requirements were that they had to have use of force training from the private detective board that would require them to know what kind of limited use of force they would have to administer on the job. Now, when you think about someone driving in front of a truck or behind a large truck, you don't typically think of dropping somebody out of their car, putting them on the ground, and then, you know, telling them their rights. You think of somebody getting out, holding up their hands, saying, okay, traffic, you stop here. So my question is, Ms. Ullman, where did that come from, number one? Did we do that at the legislature, or was that something that was devised by your organization? And then on the second part of that question is, do you have any time and strength or time goals in which you try and get these individual businesses licensed? Because in this particular case, it took about 6 to 8 months, and during that time frame when they were not licensed, they were not able to do a lot of the escort services that were determined by DOT, and so there was an uneven playing field that took place during this time frame. And, Mr. Chair, that would be my question.
Ms. Ullman, do you have a response to that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Severson, if I could generally refer to that circumstance, first of all, in regards to training, a few years ago, the legislature determined that for companies that were interested in doing solely vehicle escorts only, that we create a special, if you will, protective agent license, which basically would allow them, if granted that, to escort vehicles, whether it was for wide loads, heavy loads, to the manufactured home industry, the wind farm influx that has been occurring, and so on. The change in our statute to create that special license was that it removed any qualification that someone interested in doing that, which was previously described solely as a protective agent function, for which someone had to present to us a minimum of 3 years of experience in that particular area. That requirement was removed. So now people can come to us and say, I merely want to do the over-the-load or over-road escorts, for which they frequently must go to the Department of Transportation for a permit and so on. They wanted to be able to do that, and they comply with all of the other requirements of a protective agent or private detective license, but they do not have to come to us with that experience qualification. So in regards to the training, for instance, that they are needing to meet, we call it pre-assignment training. There are 12 hours of pre-assignment training that the owners of these businesses and their employees go through, which cover a myriad of different sorts of subject matter, including communications, legal authority, and liability issues. And there is some generic aspect to the content of that training, so that it is applicable to many different license holders and their employees as they come in to provide these services. The pre-assignment training is done, as you might imagine, prior to them beginning the providing of service. There is a reference in one of the subject areas, the legal authority area, to use of force. It is not a focus of that training, but it is indeed covered in that area. In regards to the constituent circumstance, in that individual's situation, they had actually applied for the wrong license initially when our office received it. And I was able to work with her to educate her about the difference between the escort-only license and the full-blown protective agent license, which allows the recipient to be involved in not only the escort work, but also in uniform guard, patrol, and other more traditional protective services. So we were able to work through that, and she actually had a problem with her bonding company because that is one of the requirements of the license. And I was able to work with her as well as the bonding company in order for the bonding company to understand the piece of documentation that she was going to need for the correct application, which she did submit. And so we worked, I think, very positively to make sure that she was able to get into that business area and get before the board, be reviewed, and did, in fact, receive a license.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Ullman, I guess that kind of goes to the heart of the question is, have we got a system that is so convoluted, so complex, that the individual who has been in the business for a protracted period of time is having troubles navigating through a very bureaucratic system to the point where they put in an application and 3 months later get notified that that's not the correct application, and now they've got to go through the process again. During that 3 months, there are people that they employ are restricted to the professional expertise that they are able to provide. And so I guess my question, it isn't a question, it's more of a comment, is just to say we have created a bureaucratic monster here that is not friendly towards the users or the license approachees, those people that are looking for the licenses, and be more than happy to entertain any suggestions you might have in terms of how we can streamline that system.
Mr. Chairman, I can very much appreciate that approach, and in a small office, certainly we are always striving to make sure that all of our responsibilities are met, and sometimes those time frames certainly do get challenged, and I certainly acknowledge that, and I do think that we are looking at what the statute and rule exactly say about what we should do, and are we, has the box gotten bigger just out of practice? And I can assure you we are certainly taking a very close look at those items to ensure that all those applying are doing what is necessary under the law, so that we can make sure that that box gets back to the size that it needs to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish.
Chairman Thamer and members of the committee, I think Representative Biggin has hit on something here. I'd like to a project of this committee just to look at the possible melding of these two boards. I don't know how excited that Mr. Melton's going to be about that, but I disagree with the testifier on that. I think these are very, very similar boards. They're talking about licensure, they're talking about training, they're talking about reviewing licenses, ethical violations, investigations. These people with these, under this private detective board, the uniforms, the tasers, they go through use of force training. In some ways, they're too close to a cop to make me comfortable. In Mankato, for instance, they've got the uniforms on and they're wearing the Smokey Bear hats and patches and all sorts of equipment on their belts, and they drive a vehicle around with flashing lights that say public safety. And I always wanted to change that away from public safety and put maybe security service so people would know the difference between a professional peace officer and a security guard. So some of my past, when I looked at this subject already, it intrigues me to think about at least taking a look at this as a committee and see about a possible melding together, because when the post board was formed in 78 after the private detective board, it was formed for the reason of professionalizing the whole outfit and a better system of issuing licenses. So I think it would be a natural project to undertake, and I'd be interested in looking into it with the fiscal staff and Representative Biggin just to see what it would look like.
Yes. Ms. Thoma?
Mr. Chairman, just a quick comment regarding the representative's comment about the use of public safety. That actually has been changed in statute, and it is prohibited language as it applies to companies we license. The proprietary community, those that are functioning within internal environments, that statute, since we don't license them, does not apply to them. So if you are running across a circumstance where it is a licensed provider by our agency that is using public safety, we'd certainly like to be aware of that.
Mr. Chairman, it would be, I don't know if
they
wasn't too long ago, but Mankato was the Mega Mall River Hills. They got public safety all over their vehicles, and they run around with flashing lights, not red lights, but yellow lights, and sometimes they're confused. And then there was supposed to be, I thought, some delineation or uniforms, the difference, brown for deputies, blue for PD, and the troopers have, but now public, the security guards are kind of mixing that up. Some you see in white, some in blue, and so it's such a quasi-law enforcement organization, that's why I think it would be the natural match here. But.
Very good. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have three questions, and I'll just ask them all, and then you can answer them. Who sets the fee that you charge? Do you collect more money than you spend or are allocated in the general? Do you contribute more to the general fund than you get back in allocation? And then do any other regulated industries in Minnesota have a similar setup of the board?
Ms. Bowman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, fees are determined by the board, but we also do that through the Department of, is it budget management now? we worked with them very closely in 2001, which was the last time that we changed our fees, and they were raised rather substantially at that time, as they've not been changed in a number of years. In regards to how much we collect versus what stays in the general fund unutilized, I believe we're making our requirements in terms of meeting what we expend. There have been some years past where we have left some funding behind, if you will, in the general fund, and we have overpaid. There have been several successive years where that has not been happening. However, we've been able to maintain some consistency in that area. In terms of other regulatory activity, statute actually requires board activities or licensing activities to be self-sustaining. I'm familiar with some of the boards in the Department of Commerce. There is another board which the accountancy board, the architects, engineers, et cetera, that have board activities that are also fee-driven. I am not familiar enough with their budget circumstances to know if they receive funding from other sources, but they have a responsibility in terms of fee collection as well as for their regulatory process.
Representative, were you done, Representative Wilson?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Eastman?
My question's been answered.
Okay. So, Representative Ward has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, would you just kind of educate a rookie here, please, on this public safety committee? Do they need to be post certified?
Ms. Allman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward, no, they do not need to be.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward?
Can you tell me then that, I know that you license a business, like, the overall umbrella business type thing. Would you have any statistics as to how many of those individuals that are detected either have previously been post-certified or were law enforcement personnel?
Ms. Allman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward, in order to qualify for a private investigator license, someone comes to us and they have a minimum of 3 years of full-time investigative employment experience. Some of that experience does come from having worked for a licensed agency as an employee, so they're being guided, directed, learning those skills. But we also have the ability to consider those that are either current, as there's no prohibition in statute that says that a current law enforcement officer cannot be licensed by our agency as well. But some do come to us with that law enforcement experience, whether it be a city, county. We even have some state former and current state peace officers that hold licenses, as well as retired federal people from law enforcement services like the FBI, Secret Service, and those agencies.
So, Ms. Allman, so FTEs, it's basically you and a clerical staff, I'm assuming.
Chairman, that's correct.
And you rent in on Maryland Avenue, and the rent is about, how much do you pay?
It's in the neighborhood of $13,000, I believe. Not quite $13,000. There's been a little variance.
Okay, well, unless there's any other questions, I think you appreciate that in tough fiscal times here, we're looking at trying to save every penny we can and use a very small budget.
Shoot at the comments. As other agencies come forward and, we talk about some of these small boards renting facilities, I'd be interested in knowing whether there is vacant office space at some of the facilities. I know when we went and toured BCA 2 years ago, there was some vacant space or unoccupied space at the time, and clearly there may be a need in the future for that to be used by BCA, but if we can maybe save a few bucks there, since we're already paying to have the lights on and the heat on, there may be something worth exploring. If we're gonna keep these individual boards as opposed to doing some of the things that Representative Cornish, Representative Bigham were talking about. Representative Bigham, the fiscal conservative, we're talking about.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Allman, for your testimony. And then finally, this morning, the fourth board, Mr. Melton. Mr. Melton, welcome to the committee. And again, if you can, we have some new members here, if you can maybe give us a little historical background of the post board and what your mission is and how you're doing, and then provide an overview of your budget, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Neil Melton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training. You also have a handout packet I prepared specifically for this presentation. I will call your attention to that as we go through it. My comments are going to consist of four specific areas. First, a review of what the post board is, what the post board does, and as you requested, I'll try to use a modified zero-based budget format to explain our agency, our funding, and our expenditures. The bottom line is, if you voted to create the post board today, what would it take to build this agency from scratch, from the staffing, the budget, and so forth? Secondly, I want to review the governor's budget recommendations and its impact on the post mission. Third, I want to discuss, as requested, options for a 5 or 10% reduction to the agency's budget. And lastly, as a new initiative, post-involvement in the state's new online e-licensing system, which is changing a lot of things at my organization. So, to begin, in 1978, Post was the first state in the nation to license their peace officers. They broke away from the traditional paramilitary academy setting to a college-based educational degree program. As part of that enabling legislation, the 1977 legislature created the mission of the Post Board, which was, and I quote, to enhance the profession of law enforcement in Minnesota through the selection, education, licensing, and regulation of peace officers. So for over 30 years, Minnesota has produced the best educated, most professional law enforcement agencies in the nation. And I talked to my colleagues in the other 49 states, and they would agree. We currently have over 10,000 licensed officers employed by 467 state, county, and local departments. These officers have set the standard to which other states aspire, and that's evidenced by the number of agencies from all over the nation who come to Minnesota to recruit our officers and our college candidates. The Post Board exists to ensure Minnesota maintains that high level of professionalism. To understand how Post creates and completes that mandate, I call your attention to the first handout, which is called Activities and Accomplishments. As you read down that list, I want you to focus on the first word in every line, which is an active verb. That is, we award licenses. We administer a lot of exams, from peace officer exams, part-time exams, reciprocity exams, that would be interstate reciprocity, and military reciprocity. On a biennial basis, we renew over 7,000 licenses. We've opened 32 allegations of misconduct cases, 14 impartial policing complaints, processed 24 complaints, 8 automatic revocations of licenses, and 1 administrative hearing. Also, as part of our function, I have 2 staff members who travel the state and visit law enforcement agencies as directed by the legislature. We have to pay an on-site visit to at least 10% of the agencies every year to ensure they are in compliance with policy and training mandates. In addition, there are 21 colleges that offer the Professional Peace Officer Education Program, all or in part, 2-year, 4-year, public and private, and we've just recently approved our first corporate college, that is Rasmussen. So that's a new initiative that we are undertaking. The PPOE, which is the Professional Peace Officer Education Degree Program, each college has a coordinator. We work with them closely. We evaluate the curriculum of well over 1,000 continuing education courses every year. We monitor the providers of that. We recorded over 3,000 pointer system background entries. There is a state law that requires a law enforcement agency to notify us when they're doing a background check. So if subsequent agencies background the same individual, they don't have to cover the same ground all the time. It is a very efficient and cost-saving initiative. Also, we processed 366 Federal Law Enforcement Officer Safety Act applications. What that means is retired officers who live in Minnesota that meet certain criteria can carry a firearm. We processed that. We became the repository for that because I guess we were selected to do that in the state. And we go to conferences, and the last one is, if we can get 3 people to stand still long enough, we're going to talk to them about law enforcement. So I think you'll agree the list reflects a wide variety of tasks, but it cannot be done without proper staffing. So let's go back to the question of, if Post was created today, what positions would be required? On the next handout is a listing of the current staff. Let me describe each briefly. And I'm going to start with the pre-service education coordinator. Because during my presentations to people all across the state, Minnesota's law enforcement community begins in the college classroom. They are college-educated officers. So that coordinator position is needed to go out and meet with all the colleges, all the college coordinators, all the college administrators, as well as answer thousands of questions from students who want to become peace officers. So once we have that pre-service educator position in place, we're going to need someone to test and license the candidates. Hopefully they're going to pass the exam. So we would hire a testing and licensing coordinator
to ensure that our exams are truly the capstone experience for the education. That is, people coming out of these degree programs have the knowledge base as well as the technical psychomotor skills to become peace officers. The next position I would fill is the continuing education coordinator. That is, we've got people coming in that are educated, well-trained, but Minnesota also requires officers, active officers, to complete 48 hours of continuing education every 3 years to maintain their license. Now, the state has entered in and required two specific educational courses. That is, use of force and pursuit driving emergency vehicle operation. So, in addition to those mandated courses, officers are allowed to take a wide variety of approved continuing education, from foreign languages to forensics, you name it. We approve those courses, and we approve those instructors. But after we've got the education out of the way, I would hire two standards coordinators. In fact, I did. They are former peace officers, and their job is to ensure agencies are in compliance with policy and training. They travel the state, they stay in Motel 6s all over the place. They visit the agencies, they stop in to actually face-to-face interactions with these chiefs, sheriffs, and state agency directors. They look in their personnel files to ensure they've complied with the backgrounds, criminal history, medical, psychological backgrounds for candidates, and they respond to allegations of misconduct. And I'll spend a little more time on that later. Mr. Chair, you have a...
You want to do it now?
Representative
Cole?
Would you prefer that I wait?
Go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Can you give us a little bit of a snapshot? You said that, I think earlier you said they visit 10% of the agencies a year. That's their target. Is that 10% target set forth in statute somewhere?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Yeah.
Mr.
Melton, can you give us any kind of flavor as to what your employees are finding when they're on the road? Are they finding compliance issues, or are they generally finding that law enforcement agencies are compliant with all the post board requirements? How many times are you finding non-compliance or issues of non-compliance?
Mr. Mountain.
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, when this law was enacted in 2001 and it was new, we went out and we did find violations, mainly training violations. They weren't keeping proper records that they could actually prove that the officers had attended all of these courses, because use of force is quite involved too. It's day range, night range, adverse weather shoots, long guns, short guns, and they weren't doing a good job of keeping records. It's not that we thought they were not doing it, it's just that they couldn't demonstrate that they had done it. So the first few years were a little bumpy, and my staff and I actually went out and did a few so I could get a feel for the process, and we weren't really all that well received. We have never been a statewide internal affairs unit. That's not our job. But as we switched our emphasis from one of regulator to one of resource, that is, if we show up, we want to gain voluntary compliance. We will help you get into compliance. In the subsequent years, very few problems do we find. And more often than not now, in addition to our random selection of 50 agencies a year, which we do on a random basis, we are called routinely by new police chiefs and new sheriffs, letting us know that I just got appointed to the position. Would one of your staff members come down and sit with me so that I know and my city council or the county board knows that I'm ready to go. I'm good to go right now, because the first insurance policy against liability is to be in compliance with state statutes, and we can go and get them up to speed quickly.
Representative,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Melton, could you comment, offer your opinion to the extent you're comfortable doing so? If we reduce that requirement from 10% to say 5%, and I'm just pulling a number out of the air, do you believe public safety would be compromised in the state of Minnesota? I support the checks, the random checks. But you know, as we're struggling, looking to, I mean, we just spent a whole lot of time with private detective board and the Uniform Law Commission. That's, I think, grand total $350,000 of the budget. You've got a little bit more. I think we should explore whether we can find some reductions without compromising public safety. even if they're temporary. So can you comment on that?
Mr. Melton.
Mr. Chair, members, to be honest, I don't think public safety would be compromised. We have an incredibly talented law enforcement community. I think many of the agencies look forward to getting that certificate in the mail that we signed off that you are in compliance, and they put it on the wall and they share it with the city council. I don't think reviews, we don't call them audits, we call them reviews, are excessively expensive, and I think it provides the community with a sense of relief or reassurance that their agencies are meeting the state statutes. We could save some money. I'm not sure public safety would be adversely affected.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you're going to provide us that option if we were to reduce your budget, so we will explore that in more detail, I think, later. Representative Cornyn.
Mr. Chair, members, just for a quick funny story here to let you know how these audits go. I became the new chief, and I was notified that I was going to have one of these audits. So naturally, my lump went up my throat, and I thought, whoa. So I called another chief, and he says, well, you'll be okay as long as you don't draw this inspector. So I looked at my sheet. Sure enough, that's the one that's coming. One, I guess, was they had a reputation to be a little tougher than the other. But it is a really valuable function. A new chief in a town neighboring me was brand new, and there was an audit. Well, in the meantime, the chief changed, and so he came over and basically had his stuff in a box and trying to coordinate where the other chief went, and there was a transfer of information. By the time the audit was done, at the end of the day, he had his stuff all organized in folders. He had his background separated from the personnel files, and they actually do go through and check and make sure. You don't just say your officers were trained on the range. You need documentation for range training and use of force training, and it's a nervous thing to go through, but by the time they leave, everything is categorized, and they're very helpful. It's not like some of these health inspectors that come in and find a little loose fitting on the back of a microwave and shut you down. These folks are actually very helpful, and is a very valuable service. So, and of course, I'm biased, but and I did get the certificate and hung it on my wall and went over and got some points with the council and bragged about passing the first compliance check.
Mr. Nelson, have you done a compliance check in Ramsey County Sheriff's Office in the last 10 or 15 years?
Mr. Chair, at this point, every agency in the state has been reviewed at least once. So one of my staff has been to Ramsey County.
Now, I'm really quite serious, and you know I have a legislation that I believe is going before the Citizens Committee soon. So if you did a compliance check in Ramsey County, how come you did not determine that Sheriff Fletcher hired an individual who is not a licensed police officer to do police work?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that may have been since we've had a compliance review, but I don't know that we would have found that because the person is not a licensed officer. We're only checking the records of the licensed police officers, and the person you are referring to wouldn't have been on our radar screen because he wouldn't have been a licensed police officer.
So, Mr. Nelson, is there not a gap here in enforcement? I mean, I don't know how widespread this is, but clearly, at least everything in the newspaper's account suggests that Sheriff Fletcher did this. So who does have oversight over sheriffs and police chiefs who might be hiring non-police officers to do police work?
And Mr. Chair, I've had that conversation. That's unauthorized practice. And if that allegation is made, it is going to be up to the county or another agency to actually carry the criminal charges forward through our attorney general's representative.
And
if an allegation is made of unauthorized practice, that's criminal. So go through either the Ramsey County attorney or in conjunction with our attorney general's representative. And we do not have that criminal complaint.
You currently don't have the authority, so it would have been up to the Ramsey County Attorney's Office or the Attorney General to have pressed charges against the sheriff.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we are not a law enforcement agency. We do not have that authority.
Well, I don't want to take up more time because we do have a bill that addresses that, and then we can have some more conversation about it. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Mr. Melton, this is my opportunity to ask the question. Here we got 36 military arrest examinations that took place, and I think it was a couple of years ago we had put a bill in that basically said if a military individual has 5 years of law enforcement on active duty, that they have the opportunity to take a reciprocity or an equalization licensure. Have you had an opportunity to look at the records on any of these individuals, and we don't as a legislature have opportunity to follow up much on what we pass, but my question here would be the quality of the officers and their performance in the field, and was this a good bill, I guess, is to the crux of the matter.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative DeMille, and I thank you for that question. I am a Vietnam vet, and my heart and my support goes to the returning veterans. We will do anything we can to help them make that transition, but we are not going to arbitrarily remove the standards we put in place. So the legislation was good because it ensured that we still maintain professionalism in law enforcement. That is, we have education and we have training. And coming out of the military, these people are very well trained, but may not be comparable training other than the military reciprocity. And we kept DD-214, that's a discharge paper, to ensure they meet that criteria, that their service while on duty is military police related. To be honest, we don't have that many. We have 36. Half of them failed the exam.
Mm.
That was troubling to us. We don't want to set these people up for failure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like when I came back from Vietnam and we transitioned. At the time, I was a Bloomington police officer. They required a four-year degree, and you got extra points for being a veteran. I had a four-year math degree. I walked in as a veteran. It was easy. I don't have that anymore. Law enforcement in Minnesota changed since 1976. We now work extensively with the military personnel that are transitioning these soldiers out of active duty, and it's much more defined now. I have a staff member that is working close with the family or the employee service of the Guard and Reserve to try to get them educational opportunities. For example, there's a course that's offered at Fond du Lac Tribal College. It's a one-day course on prepping for the peace officer exam, trying to get them to go there, or bring that curriculum here, or getting them ready. I was disappointed we had a 50% fail rate. We shouldn't set these soldiers up to fail, and we are working more closely than ever to ensure that does not happen again.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Melcher, I appreciate that, you know, because I think it's the responsibility for us as Minnesotans to make sure that these individuals don't fail, but also that the quality of the officers that we're bringing forward are up to the standard. So I think anything that we can do, as your department does, is much appreciated in terms of giving them the education they need to meet the bar. And thank you for that.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have so many questions. I'm trying to sort out what I want to really ask here. First of all, I want to say that I really appreciate the functions of the Post Board, and I think that having a very professional, well-trained police force in the state is very, very important and something that we should be very careful to maintain. I wanted to ask you, though, who are the people that you've got 12 FTEs in your agency? And I was looking at the budget numbers here, and your total compensation, projected the governor's recommendation, $947,000 per year. And so I did a little quick math and came out with it. That's an average of $79,000 approximately per FTE. So I wanted you to give us a little overview of who you've got working for you. I mean, you've laid out what the positions are, but I'm kind of interested in the qualifications of some of the folks. You know, are they, are they retired police officers? Are they, you know, just give me an idea. I mean, I don't have a really good sense of what a compensation package is, but an average of $79,000. I kind of want you to justify that to me, if you would.
Mr. Melton.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The top positions other than administrative support are all college graduates. That's a requirement. We've got people that work closely with colleges. They interact with college faculty, curriculum, police chiefs, sheriffs. These are all college graduates as well. Also, the Ports Board is fortunate in that employees come and they stay. I have four people that have been there over 20 years, so they're obviously at the top of their pay scale. And that average figure is salary plus fringe for the state, and these are MAPE union positions. So they're well compensated. But they've been there a long time.
Representative Raveling.
Okay. One of the things, I think, thank you, Mr. Chair, one of the things that I hope that we're going to be looking at on the committee, and I had mentioned this, I think, at the last meeting, was, and I'm not picking on you, but, you know, for all the agencies, I think we need to be thinking about, you know, not only, since we know we have to make cuts, and some of them are going to be pretty draconian, we have to look at the alternatives, and one should be whether, in certain instances, we can look at reducing salaries rather than cutting positions, and so I'd like us to really have information about salaries within various agencies, if you could maybe, I don't know if we have that already or if you would need to provide that to the committee, but I think that's something we should be looking at as we go along here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good point, Representative Liebling. So, you know, I'm sorry, Mr. Mountain, I kind of screwed up your whole presentation by, you started off and we started asking questions. Maybe you want to get back to your original presentation and finish it up and then we can go into your budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am anxious. I enjoy the question. A job without conflict is nearly a hobby. So, this is what I get paid for. So aside from the standards coordinators, I have a legislative and rules coordinator. I want to be clear. That person is not a lobbyist. That person is to ensure that the rules that we promulgate, because we have the authority to write and pass administrative rules, also to ensure all legislative initiatives that are coming forward on season and off season are reviewed carefully by the board. There is a post board, 15 members, and there are a lot, as example by this session, that have peace officer implications, and we're trying to get all those coordinated, and I find myself getting double and triple books, so I have a legislative coordinator position. The fourth is the information technology specialist. As most state agencies, certainly regulatory agencies, we live and die by our ability to hold, manipulate, interpret data. And we've got huge amounts of data going back 30-some years for peace officers, active and retired. We need to be able to quickly get information to you if it's requested. We get many requests from legislators and their aides that they want number of officers by county, height, whatever you call it, and we are able to get that information in a timely manner. I hope to turn that around within a day when you call. We have four office and administrative services positions, everything from reception to customer service to data entry with our new computers. They keep the agency running day to day. Last but not least, there's me, and my job is wide and varied and changes from day to day. I'll get home at night and Sal will ask me what I did that day, and I'll just say basic director duties, because it's just all over the map. Post currently, as you mentioned, has 12 full-time equivalent positions, down from 15 in 2001. That's a 20% reduction in staffing, but we have not reduced our jobs or our tasks. So back to building the agency from scratch. Certainly staffing and personnel take the lion's share of the operating budget. Other expenditures are routine, expected, lease office space, classrooms to administer exams, workstations, computers, communication equipment, staff development. I think the most significant expenditure, and I'm looking now on the handout with the pie chart, involves our travel budget. No post staff member has left the state traveling on business since 1999. For the past 10 years, I have not attended any of the national law enforcement conferences. Rather, I communicate with my post colleagues, email, phone calls. It's not the preferred scenario, but I think that money is better spent when we fire up the post board Winnebago and drive all over the state visiting chiefs, sheriffs, tribal agencies, city councils, county boards, community groups. I think that's a better use of the funds. So in the handout with the pie chart, you'll notice that Post is funded through a special revenue account from a surcharge on certain criminal and traffic offenses. As stated at the top, although the law directs the state treasurer to credit 39% of the proceeds of the first $25 to the peace officer account, post-budget cannot exceed the legislated base appropriations. We also get money, special revenue from certain non-DUI reinstatement fees. These are deposited in a special revenue account appropriated to post for training reimbursements to local governments. I want to show by the pie chart that over 75% of our budget is sent back to local units of government to help offset the training costs. Operating costs are 24%, and we've got board member expenses and a e-licensing fee that I will explain more on this new statewide computer system.
Mr. Mountain, the training reimbursement, are you saying the $3,559,000 goes directly back to law enforcement agencies, or is that also money that's going to contractors who are providing the training?
Mr. Chair, it is sent back directly to the units of government.
Okay.
To put into their training account or whatever account they want. It is an e-transfer to local units of government.
When we get to your budget, then, would you tell us where the money goes for all of the various contractors that... do you have a contract list of colleges and entities that can provide law enforcement training, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, do you have that list? I mean, those are all post-approved entities. Do you have that list, and who provides that kind of law enforcement training?
Mr. Chair, I do. My staff member Jennifer has it in our binary report. But may I separate the pre-service education, the 21 colleges? They don't receive any reimbursement from POST. Nor do the continuing education providers. They don't receive. The providers do not receive. The officers... agency receives the money. For example, every year we send out a request to every chief and sheriff and state agency director asking them to submit to us a detailed report of their expenditures for peace officer training the previous year, to include salaries, equipment, travel time, whatever it may cost, bullets, band-aids, that sort of thing. We then total up all those figures just to get an idea of what they're paying for training in Minnesota. This reimbursement of $3,500,000 amounts to about 15% of the total peace officer training that goes on in Minnesota. So we are not reimbursing the total amount. Some agencies it's more, some agencies it's less. But what we're looking at is when they submit those figures, we also ask them to submit the names of the officers who have worked for them for 8 months. That becomes an eligible officer. 8 months with that agency, and you're good to go. Then we take this sum of money and we divide it by the number of eligible officers. And last year, the reimbursement per officer share was $401. It's hardly covered, as you could say, the cost. But that's what the state is putting back into this from the special surcharge on criminal and traffic surcharge.
But the 21 colleges and other entities that provide these classes are obviously making a profit off of this. I mean, they're paying registration fees, et cetera, right?
Mr. Chair, actually, that's a very good point. Thank you. Prior to post the 1977 legislation, 78, it was enacted, police training, at least for me, when I was hired by Bloomington, I was sent to a BCA academy for 9 weeks. That was on the city's dime. They paid for that. Now, we have students paying their own way to get their own education prior to coming in to the profession. So the cost is borne by the peace officer candidate, not by the state.
I'm not sure I'm getting my question answered, but why don't you go ahead and finish up.
All right. I'm sorry. Moving on to the post-general operating budget. This is our operating budget, and I have my executive budget officer from DPS sitting behind us, which I think is important to understand the relationship. I don't work for the commissioner, but our agency, because we are small, we have fewer than 25 FTEs, We have to be assigned to another state agency for personnel, administration, finance, all of those services, and we are under the DPS umbrella. In the past, we've been under the Attorney General's Office, Commerce. As mentioned, I put two lines in, the final FY08 figures and the 2009 estimate. Personnel costs are there, office and exam space rentals. And, Mr. Chair, if I could get back to a comment made about going to a state-owned office building.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, before we renewed our lease, I worked with the Office of Real Estate, and we were looking at doing just that, because there were some spaces open not far from the Capitol in different buildings. We found that we weren't going to be saving anything in a per-square-foot basis. But even though the buildings are owned by the state, they still charge rent. And we weren't going to be saving anything. And it would have cost us $50,000 is where I quit listening to the moving estimate to move all of these electricity files and so forth. It was a huge amount of money, and they needed that money up front. So we did not move. We stayed where we were. Repairs and maintenance, printing, professional technical services, computer services, communications, and again, I emphasize the two travel components, in-state and out-state, out-state is zero. Supplies, equipment, employee development. Other operating costs, sort of an interesting one, we have process servers if we're going to be serving papers to a law enforcement agency, needing information for an officer's license, document shredding, miscellaneous expenses for the board. Statewide indirect costs, and bless Mr. Boyden's heart, but he's my executive budget officer. Every year we get a bill from the state for all sorts of different things that we have no control over. We have no idea how much we're going to pay, but we know we're going to pay. Indirect costs could be, well, there's 1,000 things. Last year it was $12,000. This year they're expecting it to be $26,000. If you need more specifics on that, Mr. Boyden can explain that. Attorney General costs, that's another one we have no control over. It depends on how many cases we bring forward and how many officers appeal their sanction that the board puts on us. Sometimes it's high, sometimes it's low. We always put $25,000 in that cost code. Last year we spent just about $9,000, so that was a good year. But that could change overnight. The agency provided technical services. That was one event, and that was in the Office of Administrative Hearing when somebody wanted to challenge our revocation of their license. So those are our specific budget items. Next, the governor's recommendations. While the governor's recommendations for 2010 and 11 actually on the sheet show a decrease of $25,000, that's not really true. That $25,000 was a carry forward from our previous budget. So, in essence, the budget remains unchanged. However, the last line talks about full-time equivalent positions. Those do change. We currently have 12.2 FTE authorized in 09. We dropped to 11.7 in 10, 11.3 positions in 11. Based on those figures, I anticipate one staff layoff in calendar year 2010. And it's simply too early to predict what will happen in 2011.
Representative Eastman has a question for you, Mr. Martin.
Sure. I'm just saying I want to get out of the room here. So if you ask now, I will.
Okay. Do you want to wait or do you run out? Go for it.
Well, it goes to something he was talking about just a little bit ago about the training reimbursement and that sort of thing. And I guess my question is trying to understand how continuing ed works in the fourth quarter. And if there is a licensing and a licensing renewal process, like in many real estate or whatever, and sort of continuing ed requirements. I guess I'm trying to get my arms around it. The training reimbursement we were talking about was being able to get a reimbursement for continuing ed. Is that what I'm hearing, or is the training that we're talking about something different than continuing ed?
Mr. Melton.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it is a reimbursement for training, for continuing education training.
Okay, thank you. Is there a continuing ed requirement for renewing licensure?
For the fourth ward?
Mr. Mountain.
And Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, every officer in Minnesota must complete 48 hours of approved continuing education every three-year licensing cycle.
Okay. You can tell me how this relates. If you're a realtor, if you're a teacher, or if you have a licensure in many other professions, there's a continuing ed requirement, and the individual pays for that. That's part of the cost of maintaining your license. It isn't something that the school district doesn't pay for the continuing ed for its teachers. You know, the real estate office doesn't pay for continuing ed for its realtors. If you're a builder, it's something you have to do on your own. And I guess I'm just trying to get my arms around this reimbursement thing. Why do we do that? I guess this is kind of what I'm getting at.
Mr. Mountain. Mr. Chair, Representative. First of all, I believe that the feeling is if the state is requiring two very expensive pieces of training, that's youth support, and that goes everything from your firearms to chemicals, tasers, intermediate impact weapons, handcuffing, that the state picks up part of that tab, and the pursuit driving emergency vehicle operations, which is a 7-hour behind-the-wheel program, that's expensive. So they offset that. Now, the rest of the training, some is provided by the agency, some, depending on the contract that the employee has with their agency, they may pay for it themselves. And there's a number of officers in this state who are attending graduate courses or Spanish courses, you name it, on their own dime, because they think it will help their career. They're also completing their four-year degrees, their graduate degrees. So I believe that $401 per officer per year is mainly viewed by law enforcement as a reimbursement for the state-mandated training and use of force and pursuit.
And the representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's the cost that you're talking about, because it's a very expensive kind of training to receive. It would cost out-of-pocket expense. I mean, I'm just thinking of there's lots of things the state mandates for other professions as well, that they have to go out and they have to take. They got to find somebody to offer the class. They got to go there, take time out of their day. They got to go get it. It's part of the cost of being in the profession, of maintaining your professional license and continuing to do business in that field. That's kind of the question that I'm just pursuing here. I'm not saying that what you're doing isn't right or isn't justified. I'm just having a little bit of difficulty understanding why in one profession we feel a huge obligation by the employer, which in this case is the state, to cover those costs, and other professions it's all handed off to the employee or to the individual. So I think that's just an interesting observation.
Anything further you want to add, Mr. Mountain?
No, other than for use of force specifically, agencies have a policy in place that we've written and created, the model policy on use of force. So since these officers are going to work together, perhaps in situations involving use of force, deadly force, they want them to have trained together. The department has the liability. They want to ensure that the weapons and the training are all consistent with their agency's model policies, and they do vary slightly across the state.
Maybe this is we're getting far afield here, but now that you've asked that question, so is it the board then that decides what kind of training officers should have continuing education credits? And you said use of force, but I remember I'm been here long enough when Representative Gray wanted to pursue racial profiling, and we had a huge debate here in the legislature whether that should be mandated. We had discussions a couple of years ago after the killing in Washington County about no contact orders, and who makes the decision about what is required for continuing education credits, or is that up to the individual officer to decide which class they think is most appropriate?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with all of those things, let me explain. 1999 legislation was the racial profiling legislation, and every officer in the state received training in that area. If we go back to 1990, It was hate crimes. Every officer in the state received training in that area. I helped put that curriculum together. I helped deliver it. I remember that specifically. We trained at that time well over 9,000 officers. But there were also one-time appropriations that came with that. We did that for domestic violence courses a few years ago, or many years ago, when I was still in the college system. Other than those appropriations from the legislature that mandate agencies train in a certain area, it is up to the discretion of the police chief, the sheriff, or the state agency director. What do my officers need for my community? And it varies. We've had German classes in New Ulm, and we approved those because the police chief said that's very important. We've had a number of agencies that abut or overlap tribal reservations in Minnesota that have done a lot of training in dealing with Native American populations and customs and cultures. Now, that wouldn't be required or even valuable in some departments, but for them it was. We take a broad brush in approving courses. If the police chief comes to us and says, we need this course, we want to apply for this as approved training for my officers, we give them wide latitude in their discretion. They know better what their department needs. And then at the same time, of all that training going on, the mandated, the nice training, the hope we can do this next year, computer training, whatever it may be, you see officers all the time heading out with their backpacks, heading to some college campus to take a course because it's something they want to do. It's a personal educational goal.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of, I wanted, before we adjourn, I wanted to ask my question about the private detectives board and the post.
Sure.
Was the thing, but the one thing I'd like to say, Representative Eastland, it's not always true that training isn't paid for by their employer. In the law field, legal field, sometimes the CLEs are covered by the employer. So, what is... you were in the audience when I had proposed the idea about merging or bringing the private detectives board over to your agency. Just curious of your opinion of that, or again, I see a lot of overlap with the duties. So I was just wondering your opinion on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you caught me off guard with that conversation. We're similar, we're not the same, I think, and I'm not meaning to sidestep this, but there are so many details to be involved. I have the utmost respect for Marie Ullman. I don't want this to be perceived as one agency merging with another versus overtaking another, or what's happening. Is this two agencies in one office suite with two directors? How do we do this? I apologize. I haven't had a chance to get my head around all the implications of what this could handle or what this could entail, but I'm going to do that very soon.
Representative Bingham?
Thank you, Chair Bingham. What I would like to do is I'll follow up with you and the private detectives board and Representative Cornish and see if we can't have a deeper conversation about what the implementation would be.
Mr. Melton, a quick question on the budget before we're getting close to the end here. The office and exam space rental, $95,000 roughly in 2008. What is that for?
Mr. Chair, that is our office suite. Two of the offices at the Snellman University. That's the Spruce Tree building. If you ever see the green tile building on Snellman University, that's us. It's specific for just the office, I'm not sure, but we also rent, because of exams, college testing areas. We have auditoriums that we administer the exams all over the state, so we rent that space, and we also have a boardroom in our office complex.
Okay. And back to the question I was trying to convey to you earlier, I wonder if you can provide the committee. There seems to me I saw a list that you had of all of these various providers that can provide classes, full pre-officer testing, as well as continuing education credits, post-board credits for officers. And there was like a whole list of different providers that are post-approved. Do
Do you have a list of all of those entities, how those entities get on the list, how do they get approval, and how are they evaluated for effectiveness, and how do you measure? There must be a way of measuring all this. I don't know if you want to answer that or just provide it to the committee.
Now, Mr. Chair, I can do both.
Okay.
Certainly, we have over 1,000 continuing education providers, and they come in two different categories. One are approved trainers, those that have an extensive history with the Post Board of providing quality education. Like the BCA, the State Patrol, Minneapolis, St. Paul, a lot of their courses, they can self-approve them, so we don't have to get stacks of paper every day. They have demonstrated a proficiency in doing so. We have others that want to become included in our list of approved training providers. They come out of the woodwork and they're from different states. And for a new vendor, a new provider, they send us everything. We want to know about their company. We want to know about their people. We want to know their lesson plans, their learning objectives. We want to know their assessment instruments, their student survey instruments. That's what we do with new vendors. Then they're put on a list 1 year, sort of probationary, during which we ask them to submit to us the surveys of their students. We want to know if they've done well or not, and we have pulled the approval for some vendors because, frankly, it didn't live up to their expectations of the course attendees. And so it's a series of that. We have approved vendors and then some that come and go.
Yeah. Can you provide me with that list?
I sure can.
Yes, thank you.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Melton?
I got it.
Well, thank you very much for your thorough presentation. I think we all have a better understanding of what you do and of your budget. We may ask you back. We may ask you for more information, as you know, given the budget deficit that we're having. But thank you, Mr. Melton. This Thursday, our hearing is the Sentencing Guidelines Commission as well as the Department of Human Rights. Are there any other matters before the committee? Seeing none, seeing Representative Lesh is here. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.